Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson. We are at the very end of July 2019. And I am today going to discuss something extremely unpleasant. I mean, more unpleasant than usual. Many of you have heard of it. I've been actually mispronouncing the name for a while. It's not obviously the way it's spelled, but there's a book out I've mentioned before, The Anti-Humans, Student Reeducation in Romanian Prisons. It has to do, of course, with the Pitești prison as part of the Romanian Gulag in the late 40s. Late 40s and early 50s. Pitești was a flagship system that dealt with, among other things, psychological torture methods. And that's what this is going to be about. Now, The Anti-Humans, I think most people should not read the book. And I say it, well, you'll see by the end of this, you'll understand why. I'm doing this so you don't have to read it. It's disturbing to the point where no one could have ever thought of it. It was a systematized method of torture designed to completely remake the human psyche. Romania, the end of World War II, and established in 1948, the Red Army established a Soviet satellite. And when they took over, of course, as typical, the Soviet Union, a mass of purges, prisons, economic collapse, everything that signified a total control by the Soviet Union. By the end of the 60s, there were about 150 prison camps for political crimes. It housed, at a given time, about 1 million people. Several million were kicked out of the country throughout the communist era. But as far as the prison system itself, you had roughly 2 million people. Pitești was one of the worst, but you have places like Gerla and Jihlava and a whole bunch of others. This was the core of the Romanian Gulag system. For this, Hitler was defeated. Hitler was defeated, and the Soviet Union could create its Gulag system from East Berlin to Peking. Afterwards, of course, Stalin set his sights on Greece, Italy, and Turkey, as the U.S. not only was briskly trading with the USSR, but sending aid to it. It had economic sanctions, however, on Franco's Spain. All of you know what Operation Keelhaul is. From 46 to 47, it was a forcible repatriation of refugees, anti-communist refugees, and back to Stalin. You know, the first to go were anti-communist Russians that were held in Western Austria. They had volunteered in the German army against Stalin. Those sending them back to the USSR knew that they would be tortured to death. And the majority of these guys had never been Soviet citizens. Now, the British had stated that only those living in the USSR after the start of the war, that is to say September of 39, would ever be forced to return. But this was ignored. Of course, these men were not tried, but the press referred to them collectively as Nazi collaborators. But even as early as 1944, Cossack forces were disarmed by the British and sent to the Red Army nearby, where they were immediately killed, but the leaders were sent to Moscow for trials. Most of these men had fled the USSR in the 20s and were never under Soviet jurisdiction. So beginning in the summer of 1945, almost 50,000 Cossacks were disarmed and placed on trains, shipping them to Stalin. The only survivors, a handful of survivors, were those who could endure the gulag until Khrushchev amnestied them. For the most part, by 1947, it's roughly 2 million people. There are many histories of the era that say it's only about 1,000 or so. Europe was cleansed of anti-communists and militant right-wingers by the USSR, and the West, of course, working in unison. This is critical information, though, because it shows that these regimes were established and these prisons erected with the support, acceptance, and even money of the Allied powers. They would publicly decry the crimes of Hitler, as they were supporting real, actual crimes by their allies. Much of this, of course, is psychological. They were fully aware of what was happening in the USSR. So creating Hitler as the ultimate demon is the only way that can properly be displaced. They could soothe their consciences with this. So I'm hoping for people who believe that I could now reintroduce you to cognitive dissonance. Nicolae Ceaușescu came to power, 65, 66, 67, where he consolidated his force, and the West felt all over itself, trying to please him. David Funderburk, who was the American ambassador there from 81 to 85, was weekly writing Washington, explaining to them what was going on there, the prisons, the arrests, the destructions of churches. And he said, stated in an interview to the BBC, he said they knew this, but it had no impact on policy. It helped keep Ceaușescu in power for many more years without exposing him for what he really was. Well, that policy is the mass underwriting of huge industrial projects in Romania by Western banks. And yet, of course, it's Vladimir Putin who's under the harshest of sanctions. On the grounds that Ceaușescu had condemned the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia, and he also refused, by the way, to boycott the 84 Olympics, the Americans poured cash into his country. Now, the U.S. was already heavily invested in the USSR, and Western banks were underwriting much of what they were doing there, but it never reached the point of almost obsession that Romania had received. The point was not to isolate the USSR, but rather to support a more defensible form of Marxism. Romania's case is no different than the Soviet case. Now, Johnson's Law explains why the press refused to report on the internal affairs of Romania. And without the internet, the only information we had was from the papers. Of course, none of this harmed the USSR, and it wasn't meant to harm the USSR. Only when the economy collapsed in the 80s, and the West couldn't profit from his economy anymore, he became a Stalinist. He was a good communist, they would say, kind of like Tito, because his stance wasn't so much anti-Soviet, but even Funderburk referred to it as anti-Russian. Both Richard Nixon and Jimmy Carter praised the Socialist Republic of Romania in terms that weren't really that different from his own propaganda at home. In fact, Jimmy Carter's veneration in a speech you can still find on YouTube was so intense that Ceaușescu had his people read his remarks to him over and over again that night. The West was in love with Marxism. It always has been. From the university to the State Department, Marxism was misunderstood. Now, Russians couldn't be trusted, and they were natural predators in the American mind, but the Soviets were a different story. They were good Europeans. I mentioned where Gerald Ford refused to meet with Solzhenitsyn so as not to offend Brezhnev. And remember, when you're supporting a Sovietized state like Romania, it means that defection is impossible. So Romanian dissidents were trapped. They couldn't defect to the West because they'd send them right back again. Well, that's the background information. From the end of World War II to 1951, and probably beyond that, the Romanian Communist Party began a set of horrible experiments in the Putești political prison designed to destroy a man's personality, religion, and any sense of self that the communists couldn't control. It was an experiment in what we would call today brainwashing. Now, the experiment really has been removed from any real media coverage or historical analysis. That is changing. But there's a reason for this. There was this you know, in the 90s, an interest in Ceaușescu's regime. But the reason why the crimes of Putești which were beyond human reason, were covered up was that in the early years, the Romanian Communist Party was almost entirely Jewish. And so they covered this up to protect the reputation of Jews in general. Now, a little bit later, I'm going to go through all the names and, you know, the almost not as bad as Hungary, but it was an ethnic phenomenon. Now, the book I want to talk about here, The Anti-Humans, from Dumitru Baku in 1971. The very fact that this can only be published on a minor press, it's called The Soldiers of the Cross, was the name of the publisher. No major publisher will touch it. And they won't because of the Jewish identity of those responsible. Now, there's been a bunch of other things in Romanian, but the story is absolutely gripping, just in its icy amorality and sociopathy. Under normal circumstances, the major presses in the West would be all over it. They'd be bidding on it. Well, the Batesh experiment was the most extreme of all the communist experiments to destroy the human mind. The purpose, to summarize it briefly, was to associate Christianity, the family and the nation, which, by the way, was all treated as one thing, with horrible tortures involving sexual pain, an obsession with feces, which, by the way, is very much in the Talmud, constant beating, sleep deprivation, and medical neglect. Father Roman Braga, who died recently, who spent the rest of his years in Michigan, he was the survivor of the Batesh and professor of Romanian literature. He summarized it by saying this: these prisons were considered laboratories from which they can create a communist personality. Doctors and psychologists were very important. So, in other words, nationalism and religion were treated as mental illnesses that needed to be treated. The experiments themselves were based on pure behaviorism. Really, Marxism doesn't know any other method but behaviorism. Baku writes, summarizing the mentality of these tortures, but specifically organized scientific tortures. He summarizes it this way. This is from chapter 6. Everything in the past which could offer any kind of refuge was to be muddied and denigrated. This included the heroes of history and the folklore of Christian inspiration. Then, to be given special attention, was the destruction of love for family, in order to completely isolate the victim in his own misery, bereft of religion, love of country, and family. This would break the chain that links together a community of national thought and gives meaning to a national struggle. When the individual was thus cut off from history, faith, family, the ultimate step in re-educating him was to destroy his existence as a personality, as an individual. This, to the victim, was to prove the most painful step of all, and it was called his unmasking. Unmasking was a euphemism. It's part of the Masonic nomenclature. There's a skull at the base of a Masonic altar. And what it means, you know, the hammer, the skull and crossbones insignia is very Masonic. It is what we mean here of as unmasking. It's the social body with the skin torn off. All appearances are thrown aside that reveal the essence underneath. Now, of course, Masonry is mystification, but this is at least what they claim. The tortures and methods that they used to reprogram the brains of these victims is really the psychology of mass society. One tactic was to have different groups of prisoners beat each other. Getting one group of prisoners to attack another with promises of privilege or even freedom was to destroy hope and trust in one another. Rendering the individual totally isolated and helpless was the purpose. One of the things that they wanted to inculcate was that Marxism, socialism, etc., was inevitable, and that all resistance is futile and therefore is irrational. When they ate, the rare times they ate, they had to eat on all fours, and they were forbidden to use utensils. The point was to make them actually believe they were pigs. They would become less than human. Sitting on a bed, and their tortures really just, you know, the prisoner was forced only into one position and couldn't move. When they slept, they could only sleep in one position, often on their backs, and any movement was forbidden. This was called supervised sleeping, and of course it led to there being no sleep at all. They would be forced to, for example, stand on one leg, with a backpack, maybe 40 pounds, without moving for a long period of time. Now you try doing that for 5 minutes. They were forced to clean toilets and their own underwear with their mouth, making them feel that they themselves were fecal matter. This was a manure from which the new socialist man would be born. That would force the most severe exercises that had to be done thousands of times until muscles tore and joints literally wore out. Now, as this is all going on, preaching, religious doctrine, even chant would be played in the background. And the point was to associate this inhuman agony with the church. So they would promise freedom to prisoners who would assist in re-education of others. And then they would go and they would do whatever they were told to get out of there. And of course, no one then would trust anybody. There is a YouTube, documentary which can be found on YouTube. It's called Beyond Torture, The Gulag at Pitești, Romania. But there's not a whole lot of English works on it. Magrescu, 1994, wrote a book called The Devil's Mill, Memories of the Pitești Prison. And his description goes like this. In the so-called act of depersonalization, students were forced under torture, permanent and unimaginable torture, to betray all they held dear, God, their own parents, brothers, sisters, friends. They were constrained to drink urine and to eat feces. The human being was thereby annihilated. Disgusted at his weakness, he would never be able to recover himself before his own conscience. The pain was beyond the power of human endurance. Then he's talking in the first person. Then they undressed me. What followed is indescribable. Beatings on the head to induce stupefaction. Beatings in the face for disfigurement. Thousands of blows to the back, below the ribs, in the plexus, and the soles of the feet. Dozens of fainting, and then over and over again, hours on end. And the eye, the peephole, always watching, always watching. They shattered my ribs, my lungs, liver, kicking my bones, my kidneys, with shod feet. So the mentality at work here is torture based on the behaviorist conception of association. Under the most extreme kinds of pain, prisoners were to associate the faith, the Orthodox faith, with these experiences, making the faith seem disgusting. But in their weakened state, all their normal defenses are broken down. The point, hopefully, was they can never look at a cross again without these, feeling these experiences. It's an early experiment in induced PTSD. Here's another explanation. This is from Mercy in 2008. Performances on religious subjects, black masses staged at Easter or Christmas, horrified the detainees. On such occasions, it was the theology students who would suffer the most. Dressed up as Christ, clothed in Catholic, smeared with excrement, they were made to take up communion with urine and feces. Instead of the cross, a phallus was fashioned of soap, which all the others were made to kiss. Alongside, the hymns were sung with scabrous words in which the commonplaces were insults against Christ and the Virgin Mary. Sometimes the detainees were stripped naked. Sexual plays also performed at the orders of the guards. On Good Friday, the guards shared out the role of the ass is filleted or blown by Mary Magdalene. Joseph sodomizes the ass, or the donkey, which in turn stands up with its muzzle in the lap of the Virgin Mary whore. Concomitantly sodomized by Jesus, the re-educated, headed by Trichinel, one of the guards, displayed a diabolical pleasure in mocking the faithful, nicknamed mystics. Such scenes had a terrible effect on the victims, who as a rule found their only solace in the faith itself. However, after participating in black masses, their entire faith was shaken to its foundations. This is one of the more sanitized versions of what went on there. See, the intellect uses concepts and language. It's a step removed from reality. What they were attempting to do in this prison was to go beyond or go even more primeval than words and go straight to the immediate affective passions. Emotions and reactions are immediate and come before any intellect. The intellect, of course, you have to think about it. You have to put it in conceptual and logical form. You notice, I'm sure many of my listeners already noticed, that this sounds familiar. The Talmud says the exact same thing. In fact, I like to think that this really wasn't necessarily a behaviorist scientific experiment, but really a Talmudic ritual designed to celebrate its rule over Christian society and revenge over the government that at one point kept the Jews from power. The concept of collective guilt and punishment is very much part of Talmudic culture. Even Ceausescu, you know, who was not Jewish, was another displacement of Jewish guilt, making him into a monster permits the more Jewish-oriented communists before him to seem decent. I said this before about Stalin. Using Stalin, making him into, you know, this monster, not as bad as Hitler, of course, but a monster, makes Lenin and Trotsky seem good. Starting in the 1960s, communists world over began to reject Stalin, their former hero, calling him a nationalist and an anti-Semite. But the same was done with Ceausescu, and today even North Korea's. And this comes from Trotsky's wealth and immense influence the generation before. Not to say these regimes were defensible, just that they were not Jews, and therefore served as a means of displacement, displacing guilt. This is the same from Mirsky in 1997. He describes it this way. You were made to tug at each other's genitals, or one of them would put his penis in your mouth. If you soiled yourself during beatings, you were made to eat your own feces and lick the dirty long johns or eat another's feces from your own mess tin, without being allowed to wash it after that. You were made to kiss each other's bottoms. You were made to urinate in each other's mouths. When you begged for water, you would be given urine from the bucket or they would urinate in your mouth. Others would spit in your mouth. You were made to spit in each other's bottoms and lick it up. They would wipe a stick smeared in feces from the WC, I don't know what that means, on your mouth. You were made to stick your finger up your bottom and then suck it. You know, the Talmud is obsessed with anal sexuality, and it suggests a connection between the Jewish religion and this kind of torture. Some of you may note that there are certain postmodern pornographic motifs that sound a bit like this. You know, pornography is exclusively Jewish, and the evidence that this is a ritual form of control, a Judaic ritual form of control, is very powerful. Today, men pay to see this sort of sexuality in pornography, sponsored by the largest media corporations in the West. What was at one time seen as the worst, most dehumanizing form of torture is today considered arousing. Another writer, Pavin from 1997, says this. This is also all from the Romanian. With indescribable fury, they began to beat him with fists, cudgels, and feet, to toss him one to another until the bloodied wretch fell almost senseless and could no longer rise. They gave him a few more kicks to the head. Two of them picked him up and threw him on the bunk, making him sit with his hands in his pockets and his head bowed, according to the order. Then another followed, then another, as though in a devilish ring dance intended to annihilate the last speck of physical and moral resistance of those who entered into their rabid game. There's an artist, young guy, who did a series of paintings. The survivors described the scene to him, and he tried to bring it to life. And it's on display in Romania, and the survivors, that he was actually done about 20 years ago, said it was about Corinth. You notice I said the phrase ring dance, and he doesn't tell us what it is. I don't want to know what it is. Unfortunately, I do know what it is. And it's actually the subject of one of the paintings that this man has done. It was a forced homosexual perversion that today is almost mainstream. I'll describe it no further. But the point is this. External resistance is one thing. That was crushed by the Red Army. But the revolutionary of the 20th century wasn't satisfied with that. Internal resistance had to be crushed as well. The point of all this was to destroy Christianity. So prisoners had to blaspheme. They took all kinds of vulgar oaths. That when they were ordered to pray, but then they had to use foul language during it. They were altering the very nature of communication. They were replacing language with sexual and pornographic verbiage. And the filthy speech movement of the 60s was very Jewish, sponsored by government universities in California and New York. So, The Antihumans, the book that we're talking about here, describes even more the religious side of things. All students were forced to deny and revile Christianity whether they believed in God or not. The church had to be denounced as an organization under whose mask of faith swindles were perpetrated, plots were hatched, extramarital rendezvous were arranged with priest cooperation, young girls corrupted, women came to show up. The church was described as a place where the fight against the Communist Party was organized, where in the shadow of holy icons, arrangements were made for the assassination of the leaders of the working people, etc. There were no priests among the students in prison of protest. The ODCC's anger was directed against the sons of priests. Through their mouths, once the church be denigrated, they themselves must denigrate their fathers in the blackest possible terms. Jokes and anecdotes about the clergy were making the rounds of Romanian villages that were now giving the stamp of authenticity. The priest had been described as a drunkard, skirt chaser, thief, contemptuous, inveterate liar, who had sold out to the class of capitalist exploiters, but an agent of Nazi German influence, and was responsible for the breakdown of village morality. That seems tame. We're talking about this as a propaganda element during a period of starvation, sleep deprivation, torture, and beatings. If you were to tell one of these guys this, they would laugh at you, but the weakened mind would begin to absorb this and think it's true at a subconscious level. Once the brain was shut down and resistance seen as futile, they would then absorb this message without resistance. It would then become a part of them. That was the purpose. That was the nature of the experiment. The subconscious acts immediately. Consciousness acts immediately. That which is immediate is more powerful than that which is mediated. He goes on. This is chapter 10. Each student, as part of his unmasking, had to give lectures in the most filthy terms about the men who he had once venerated, accusing them of every conceivable crime and vice. Since the students were young and had only imperfect recollections of Romanian political history before their own experience began, these lectures were ludicrous, containing accusations that were chronologically impossible or politically preposterous, based on a confusion of one man with another or one event with another that happened years before or later. In other words, this is, again, coming, you know, this is what translated into English. What he's saying here is that the heroes of the past, could be your own father, could be an old king, monarch, soldier, whatever it is, had to be denigrated in the most vile terms. You had to go on and say this to anyone who would listen during this particular time. They call prisoners students because the whole concept was re-education. So when I say student, you know, they really mean prisoners. So the use of filthy language coupled with torture creates a destroyed personality that then is rebuilt, taking vulgarity as normal and normative. It's a way to induce materialism by violence. And you see this, again, in all materialistic societies. The mythology about the Roman Catholic clergy in the America, in the U.S., the saturation of media coverage, well, there's been no convictions for anything. But that's not the point. The point is the same here, to put the suggestion into their minds, the dumbed down and worn out minds of the American proletariat. Then he goes into more detail. A student had to renounce his own family, reviling them in such foul and hideous terms that it would be next to impossible ever to return to natural feelings toward them again. While the most beautiful pages ever written have been in praise of a mother, at Potash, the most offensive words were uttered to degrade her name. The prime character which a student had to attribute to his mother during his unmasking was that of a prostitute, since only a moral prostitute could give birth to such a moral monster. All students before their unmaskings were, naturally, moral monsters. So the church, nation, family, the communists considered as one thing. But in that regard, though, the Marxist Jews here certainly made a very powerful statement, that the essence of the Gentiles' political system is a healthy one, going from family to nation, and it finds its heart in the church. So to destroy it meant the most intense psychological torture to reprogram the mind. I knew Father George Cauciu, who was a pastor when I was living in Fairfax County, Church of the Holy Cross in Alexandria, VA, Virginia. He was a survivor of Potash. And he says this, and he died not too long ago. They took very distinct steps. The first was to destroy the personality of the youth. For example, the guards would come together with a group of young prisoners who had converted to communism in a cell. There were perhaps maybe 20 young students and tried to intimidate them. They would beat them without mercy. They could even kill somebody. Generally, they would kill one of them, the one who opposed them the most important one. Generally, he was a leader. They would beat him and even kill him. Thus the terror began. That was the beginning of the terror. After that, they began to unmask. They wanted to force you to say, I lied when I said I believe in God. I lied when I said I love my mother and my father. I lied when I said I love my country. So everyone was denying every principle, every feeling he ever had. That's what it means to be unmasked. It was done in order to prove that we are the products of the bourgeois, and the bourgeois are liars. We lie when we say that we are virgin, we are Christian, when we try to preserve our bodies for marriage. They tried to say I was a prostitute, a young man that had connections with all the girls. We would be tortured until we denied everything we believed before. So that's what it means to be unmasked. It was done in order to prove that Christian principles were not principles, that we lied when we said we loved Jesus Christ, we love God, Father, Mother, and so on. It was to show that I lied when I said that I was a chaste man, when I held the ideal of nation and family. Everything had to be done to destroy our souls. That is the second step. Now, interrupt here for a minute. Clearly here, the word bourgeoisie or bourgeois is a code word. Orthodoxy and nationalism are the opposite of bourgeois values. When a Marxist uses terms, do not assume that they're used in the same sense that we use conversationally. This particular form of torture is to bring self-hate on the victim, to deny what you really believe, to even scream these blasphemies. You start to hate yourself. You see yourself as weak and contemptible. But even if you have changed your mind, which is unlikely, you're still forced to confront the fact that you believed in this nonsense before. Torture is meant to eliminate the sense of self. None of this was about getting information. It was about creating the Marxist new man. He concludes this way. This is Father George again. After this came a declaration against everyone who was in touch with us, everyone who believed as we believed. I was to make a declaration against everyone who knew about my organization or my actions, to denounce everybody, father, mother, sister. We were to sever completely any Christian connection and moral people. The final step was to affirm that we had given up all the principles of our faith and any connection we had with it. With this, we began to be the new man, the communist man, ready to torture, to embrace communism, to denounce everybody, ready to give information, to blaspheme against God. This is the most difficult part. For under terror and torture, one can say, yes, 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 but now we have to act. It was very difficult. It was during the third part that many of us tried to kill ourselves. Father George, in interviews as well as in written work, notes that one of the great targets of these tortures were trust, the concept of trust. Trust is the foundation of all society or any social action at all. No revolution can ever exist in a society where people trust one another. You know, the concept of the informant, the idea that in any given area you have a few people who are working for the police, people who have, you know, who are undercover. It's not even so much to get information. It's to destroy the organization. Since anyone could be an informant, communication breaks down. All trust is gone. In the documentary Beyond Torture, Father George says some of us went mad. The induced weakness of the victims allowed to absorb the propaganda as truth. See, propaganda works if those exposed to it are actually suffering. Cognition breaks down. Truth takes on a whole new meaning. But what is torture, really? In 1989, Professor Spitz wrote The Psychology of Torture, and he said it this way. And he's speaking in general, not about Romania, but just in general. Detention without trial and torture bring constant reminders of the helplessness of the victim and can result in severe regression to emotionally pre-verbal vulnerability. In such a state, mature defense mechanisms are lost and the victim has to resort to primitive mechanisms such as splitting, dissociation, and interjection. We can mention the widely documented defense of identification with the aggressor. The torturer is interjected or swallowed whole as a psychic attempt to control an intolerable conflict situation. However, the victim also interjects the torturer's abusive and negative views of himself. This can also lead to self-destructive attitudes and behaviors. Under conditions of torture, where emotions and physical reactions have to be repressed, the victim's sense of coherence and self-experience are shaken, and she begins to lose a sense of familiarity with herself. The identity begins to fragment. If we add at this point the experience of extreme physical pain, where the contents of consciousness dissolve, They'll experience a breakdown in conviction of the very existence and reality of the external world and the unreality of herself. All that may be left is physical pain, an internalized definition of themselves as non-human, worthless, and deserving of this torture. These unconscious traumatic meanings that the victim attaches to this experience reflect the underlying shattering of the archaic narcissistic fantasies. The victim can no longer believe in their invulnerability, nor in the safety of anybody else. Victims are powerless to defend themselves against mental or physical abuse, and therefore their vulnerable grandiose fantasies shatter. In addition, their fantasies of idealized merge just disintegrate because their images cannot protect or rescue them. And the new authority figures are brutal, and they do the assaulting. Now, that's strangely written, but I don't know, the author, he was very faddish back in the 90s to use a female gender when you would normally use a generic, but about 100% of torture victims are men. But the point here is clear. Torture destroys the self. It destroys the identity of the victim. Any sense of the future, self-esteem, even self-confidence are destroyed. In Romania, the men so tortured no longer had a past. Their memories were meant to be altered. Torture leads to suggestibility, and suggestibility is the lifeblood of revolution. The concept of destroying the victim's whole mental universe is really the basis here. The greater the pain, the greater the regression. The greater the pain, even language is overpowered. The victim becomes more and more primitive. The victim is drawn into himself and then is focused on nothing else. Over time, the world outside the prison dissolves, and even the body disappears. The pain alone remains. The longer the pain endures, the more consciousness abstracts from everything else, and it leaves the body entirely, and the pain takes on a life of its own. The self is gone. That's the point. Putting it differently, this kind of torture was designed to reset the default settings of the victim's mind. A word for a phrase that's been used is traumatic indoctrination. It's another word for brainwashing. There's a guy who specializes in narcissism. He's kind of well-known, Sam Vaknin, and he wrote Malignant Self-Love in 2001, and he defines, the section is called The Psychology of Torture. And he says, torture is about reprogramming the victim to succumb to an alternative exegesis of the world proffered by the abuser. It's an act of deep, indelible, traumatic indoctrination. The abuse also swallows whole and assimilates the torturer's negative view of him, and often as a result, is rendered suicidal, self-destructive, or self-defeating. You know, in all the definitions I've come across, the word torture, getting information from somebody is almost never mentioned. Torture is framed as a means of gaining information, you know, the so-called, you remember the debate a few years ago on torture. Now, torture is far more holistic than this. In Vaknin's essay, he talks to there's a 1983 CIA pamphlet called Human Resource Exploitation Training Manual. And they talk about torture this way. The purpose of all coercive techniques is to induce psychological regression in the subject by bringing a superior outside force to bear on his will to resist. Regression is basically a loss of autonomy, a reversion to an earlier behavioral level. As the subject regresses, his learned personality traits fall away in reverse chronological order. He begins to lose the capacity to carry out the highest creative activities, to deal with complex situations, or to cope with stressful interpersonal relationships or repeated frustrations. Some of you may recognize this, the concept of learned helplessness. It's been an important idea in psychology for a long time. The definition is when someone is repeatedly subjected to a negative experience or trauma that they can't escape, the person will stop trying. They'll stop trying to avoid the event and simply accept its dominance. He won't try to fight it anymore. Even to the point where opportunities of escape are ignored. Of course, this is a totalitarian's dream. The incessant claim, we hear this all the time, that, you know, modernism, technology, this is inevitable. Stupid phrases like you can't turn back the clock or something like that. It's conditioning people to believe that any action to change things will fail, and you may be mentally ill for even trying. it's hard to escape because it becomes a negative cycle. A victim may give up trying to escape, which makes them even more prone to be victimized in the future. And this is from the CIA, of course. The CIA refers to learned helplessness as apathy. And the concept of apathy comes from prolonged use of pain and suffering. There's a tripartite method: debility, dependency, dread. The manual says if the debility, dependency, dread state is unduly prolonged, however, the arrestee may sink into a defensive apathy from which it is hard to arouse him. They quote a psychiatrist, Hinkle, in his paper, "The Physiological State of Interrogation Subject as it Affects Brain Function." The result of external pressures of sufficient intensity is the loss of those defenses most recently acquired by civilization, the capacity to carry out the highest creative activities, etc., as I mentioned before. Relatively small degrees of homeostatic derangement, fatigue, pain, sleep loss, anxiety may impair basic functions. As a result, most people who are exposed to coercive procedures will talk and usually reveal some information they might not have revealed otherwise. In other words, torture throws the entire organism out of balance. The virtues and defenses that we've developed over time depend on a normal situation to function. In the day-to-day life we lead, it's all a context. You know, the virtues we may have requires our essential sanity, requires everything around us to be present. But when normality is eliminated and pain put in its place, a new personality emerges. It wasn't about getting information, it was about altering the population. The so-called debate over torture, some of you may remember this, coming from the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, and the equally harsh scandals from Guantanamo Bay. It was a very scripted debate, of course, and it didn't come close really to the issue. Part of the issue was that it was meant to bring, you know, any kind of Arab nationalist into a state of abulia. The court case, which very few people talk about, Hamdi versus Rumsfeld, 2004, established that non-citizens, even hostile non-citizens, have all the rights of naturalized or Native Americans. This escaped everybody's notice. Rasul versus Bush, 2004, said the exact same thing concerning Guantanamo Bay. Now, Antonin Scalia, of course alive at the time, prior to the case, said that a jury trial shouldn't be granted to hostile non-citizens. He was forced to recuse himself from the case for having said that. In fact, two justices were forced from voting on that case. You notice how different this is from the treatment of post-war German POWs. It seems the torture issue is far deeper than human rights at Guantanamo or Al-Grabe. Torture is a general state of imbalance and fear. Whether it be direct pain or the endless, you know, our psyche is exposed to images of mass killings, priestly abuse, school shootings. Over time, it destroys faith in one another. It gives the impression that you can't trust anybody. All the buttresses, to the extent they ever function at all, are depicted as destroyed, moribund. What takes its place? Either globalized cipher of liberalism or the communist new man of the Soviet. So who's responsible for all of this? I'm not going to explain the tortures anymore. Who's responsible for this? After the war, the entire Communist Party of Romania was Jewish, and every single one of these people got away with their crime. The informal head of the party was Anna Pauker, whose real name was Hannah Robinson. She authorized the tortures of these Gentiles. They used to call her Stalin in a skirt. The director of prisons was Joseph Kohler, Jewish, of course, and a Pauker is Jewish, who oversaw these experiments. By the way, by the time when Pauker was finally removed from power, the experiments came to an end. I also should note that Anna Pauker was alone amongst pro-Soviet leaders in promoting the mass immigration of Jews to Israel. So as she was torturing Romanian nationalists at home, she was promoting Jewish nationalism abroad. Now, she was purged, but she wasn't killed. She died of cancer in 1960. George Stoica, who was born Moscu Kon, was one of the founders of the Romanian Communist Party. Sigi Biner, who was head of the secret police. Avram Bunasiu, who was born Abraham Gutman, was a Romanian minister of justice and foreign minister in the new Soviet government. George Gaston Marin, whose real name was Grossman, was a Romanian minister of energy, and, among many other things, in post-war communist Romania. Alexandru Nikolsky, who was born Boris Grunberg, was the head of the Securitate early in the communist regime. Gida Mosu, Silviu Brucan, whose real name was Saul Buchner. These were powerful early party members during this time. Jacob Breitman, who went by the name of Joseph Gisvici, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, wasn't his real name, another important founder of the party. All of these people, these were all major bureaucrats in the post-World War II Romanian Communist Party. Anna Toma, also another Grossman, another early leader in the movement to torture Gentiles, Mihail Florescu, was Minister of Petroleum in 1945, in charge of transferring Romania's oil to the USSR. Gila Vas, Simeon Buici, who was the Romanian ambassador to Moscow, then later foreign minister. Leontu Ratu, whose real name was Lev Eugenstein, was the head of propaganda, and he covered up the corruption of this new regime. Mihail Roller, powerful party member who wrote the Communist Constitution of Romania. Dulgheru Mai was colonel in Romanian state security and deputy inspector of all communist prisons in Romania at the time. Alexandru Nikolsky, which I mentioned before, born Grunberg. These were the people who ran the prisons. They're the ones who sent tens of thousands to hard labor camps. By the way, they in 1980s, they emigrated to Israel and they got away with their crimes. I could go on. I butchered their names. Romanian could be weird that way. Kind of like Gaelic. It never sounds the way it's spelled. But you get the point. The Jews are the anti-humans here. And the book references all of them. The Jews around the world who covered for them have much to answer for. This is what the greatest generation fought for. This is what happened when Hitler was defeated. These men knew what would happen when these Jews took over whole nations. Churchill himself, as we all know, spoke of the connection of Judaism and Marxism. They have much to answer for. It's easy to prove that communism was a Jewish ethnic movement, which is why you're not allowed to talk about it in much of Europe. You see, the whole point of history as an academic discipline is to tear away the mystifications that the powerful use to cover their crimes. The point of being a historian is to uncover conspiracy. Powerful people operate that way. Conspiracy is how powerful people function. They never say that. They never act, you know, in public, they never say that. They give this whole story and hope you believe it. Our job is to rip that facade away. That's the last thing that historians are going to do today. Historians will never do that. They often don't have the capability, and they also know what's going to happen if they even try. Now, there have been many attempts, all failed, to bring some of these men to justice. Many of them went to Israel, as I mentioned. And a lot of people who approach this issue don't realize the Jewish issue, the Jewish problem here. Since 2004, there have been several criminal complaints filed against different guards and bureaucrats at the time. There is a state-funded institute for the investigation of communist crimes in the memory of Romanian exile, which the abbreviation comes to ISMR, or ISMR. And it's all been put into one file called file number 35. 2005, several groups filed a complaint against 210 former officers from different prisons at the time. Not to mention, included what we would call victim impact statements from those who survived. Like all the rest, it all went absolutely nowhere. In fact, nobody had been investigated, charged, or prosecuted. 2013, of the 210 that were initially charged, only five people saw the inside of a courtroom. And one of them was the former commander of the Batarta Alba in Prava camp, deputy commander of the Gerla prison, who died in 2013, a guy named Florian Cormos, another commander, several from the Gerla prison, actually. And in 2013, the organizations refiled the 2007 complaints. Now, part of the problem is how Romanian law is, a lot of the former detainees couldn't testify. This is because Romanian law forbids the use of non-parties that have no immediate connection to the litigants. In fact, the only civil party admitted was Anna Srina, the daughter of Emil Barbs, former political detainee at one of the major prisons. It just seems very convenient that because they're not direct parties, they can't do anything. The strange thing is that the criminal complaint that these guys filed was so poorly written that it couldn't go anywhere. But this is a state body that has lawyers all over it. So it has to be deliberate. An excellent article by Dragomir and Stanescu that argue that the 2013 charges against a few guards, they say that it suggests that it was primarily designed as a propagandist tool to be used to support some hidden political agenda. Well, they're being protected. These guys know a lot. It doesn't answer the question. Why destroy their own case? One of the guys is Visinecu, who was one of the guards. But he's charged only with the crimes he committed in the Surat prison. No reference to crimes he committed elsewhere, like the Mislia prison. These were deliberate omissions. They, you know, wrote this indictment in a way that could never pass muster in the court system. But all this organization does is investigate the old communist regime. That's all they do. And when it comes to file charges, they do it incompetently. They write this way. They say, as far as the Romanian Nuremberg associations being made, international media go, there is no such thing. This exaggeration once again may suggest that the ISMR or has a hidden agenda, trying to win foreign sympathy for the current government. Or as a comparison was initially made by Rodu Preda, president of ISMR, it may simply be that the current president of the group and his team of researchers are simply not very competent in their research duties. Don't hold your breath for a Romanian Nuremberg. Any successful prosecution will lead to a very long, will reveal a Jewish paper trail and could bring the government down. This isn't the military court had full jurisdiction. This is a national court. The evidence is overwhelming, but the case is being deliberately poorly presented. They're not lacking expertise. There is no will, and there will be no convictions. ISMR is a state-funded organization that does nothing all day but investigate communist crimes. How incompetent can they be? Now, I want to note, it took me a while to figure this out, but while it's a state organization, they do have some private funding sources. Now, one of them is the National Institute for the Study of Totalitarianism. That group puts the Soviet regime in the same category as the Legionary Government, Antonescu, or even Carol II. There's also the Society for Romanian Studies, which is almost exclusively a foreign body. It's mostly American academics. It's a very liberal, American institution. And then there's the Konrad Adenauer Foundation, an extremely left-wing institution financed by the most elite groups in Europe. Now, we don't know how much effect they have on policy, but it may have something to do with the fact that no one is being prosecuted there. I should note something else, though. Once Pauker was purged, and by the time of the early 50s, when the Pitești tortures were revealed, what the government did was imprison, even execute, a few guards, a few directors. Now, this wasn't for any sense of justice. Obviously, the people who were doing the execution were the same ones who ordered them to do what they did. they needed to find scapegoats, as Father Roman said. They pretended they were rogue agents. You know, they had nothing to do with us. Anyway, it's probably a good idea to avoid this book and books like it. You know, its extreme descriptions of torture would affect even the toughest, most, you know, experienced reader. You know, one of my old pet peeves is the claim that the USSR wasn't true socialism, or socialism doesn't really work like that. I hate that response. It's dishonest. And all you have to say is, well, if that's the case, then the USA isn't true capitalism. It's the most dishonest argument they could make. When a political point of view fails over and over and over again, the proper response is to abandon the political view, not to attack those imposing it, not to say that they didn't know what they were doing. Politics isn't on a piece of paper. It's not a book. It's the practice of ideas and institutions. Romania under the Jewish regime is socialism. This is what Marx meant in his very secretive recipe for the man of the future. It's always fascinated me, as long as I've been involved in this, that Karl Marx wrote volume after volume after volume criticizing the capitalist system, but never explained what's to take its place. Rarely he would give a vague mention of the Renaissance man, you know, who could do, you know, have different jobs throughout the day, but no more than that. He's completely unique in that regard. Marx's elitist Jewish apocalyptic messianism is at the root of his own theory, as well as at the root of later interpretations like Lenin and Trotsky. You know, a Christian can't explain heaven because there's no words to describe it. We haven't experienced anything like that. The Jewish left could never tell us what life would be like under communism because only initiates know the agenda. We don't have the words to comprehend. Words like labor and the proletariat, the way we use the phrase, it held no interest for Marx or Lenin. It was only the revolutionary group that would bring the Jewish utopia into power. Romania's Ptesh prison is this utopia in miniature. This was life under socialism. Both Marx and Engels worried that the workers would never accept their agenda. So Engels created the Vanguard Party idea that was the core of Soviet ideology before 1918. This is why very few workers were actually involved in anything having to do with socialism. Engels called it false consciousness, though Marx also mentioned it. It refers to workers that don't accept the Marxist view for one reason or another, and therefore couldn't be trusted. They would be forced to be free, as Rousseau would say. Although Rousseau, I'm sure, didn't mean that. Marx and Lenin knew that the new order had to be materialist and therefore atheist. It had to be also international. No one disputes that. But the problem is, the workers and peasants that they pretended to serve reject those ideas vehemently. In fact, the states they sought to overthrow were often far more secular and globalized than the citizens. As always, science was brought to the rescue. Psychology would be made into a revolutionary science in order to alter the brain, to destroy these offending thoughts. In other words, all materialist societies rely heavily on psychology to force conformist behavior. The communists failed. Father Ramon Braga, who I mentioned before, who lived for many years in the monastery in Michigan, was described by everyone who knew him as a man full of joy and peace. He was always happy. He died at the age of 93 in 2015, I believe. Everyone who knew him there looked upon him as a role model and exemplar of how to deal with the extremes of suffering the modern world has imposed on us. Father George, who also passed on, said many times, said to me, but those who survived the system intact became even better Orthodox people than they had been going in. Now, it's true, many killed themselves, many were killed, many went insane. But those who survived never abandoned the faith. And the reason is because Karl Marx and Lenin and all materialist systems, whether bourgeois, socialist, whatever, there's not much difference there. They don't understand what a spirit is. All they know is material cause and effect, nerve endings, stimuli. That's all they understand. That's all the human being is, except for them, of course. Therefore, they can't comprehend how they could have failed. They followed every behaviorist canon. Everything should have been You know, cause and effect says that they should be like this. They can never look at a cross again. And yet, they do. They don't understand what the Spirit is. And so they failed. And they failed and they failed and they failed. Liberalism is better. Marxism, the way it was organized, it was very crude. Bourgeois materialism, however, is done in the name of freedom and choice and consumerism and, you know, wealth and free sexuality and all this stuff that makes it a heck of a lot more attractive than socialist realism. Bourgeois materialism is far more effective for that reason than the Marxist version. So they failed miserably. They're going to fail again. They will always fail for that. They don't understand what the Spirit is. Anyway, prison, Romania in Ptesh, the site of the most gruesome experiments, trying to reprogram the brain to hate God and family and the nation, all considered one thing. No one was ever brought to justice. It is a deeply corrupt system. There's not going to be any Romanian Nuremberg. It isn't going to happen. The Romanian Communist Party, as I've shown, from 45 to at least the mid-50s, was a Jewish ethnic organization. Therefore, the Ptesh prison tortures were almost a Jewish ritualistic torment of the Gentiles. It was almost a fantasy of the most drunken rabbi at Purim come to life. That is the Jewish utopia. That's what socialism really is. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.